Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, June 3rd, 2019. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com. We give you a few free reads, ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And in Washington, senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Christine has a new mic setup, and we will see if the sound quality of this multi-city podcast can be improved. We won't really know until you guys listen, so here's hoping.
Let the great experiment begin.
The experiment commence. As the Democratic Party has decided to experiment by moving the California primary up to Super Tuesday next year from its usual position in June, this is a huge development in many ways. Generally speaking, for just quick history, both parties have favored having early primaries in relatively small population states on the grounds that this equalizes the money advantage between candidates, and candidates can actually go door to door in Iowa, New Hampshire, and even to some extent in South Carolina. They can make personal contacts, personal appeals, spend a lot of time generating enthusiasm among small groups as a kind of synecdoche for the larger party's feelings, and what they do there then expands outward to everywhere else. And so there has been a bias against having a big population state go relatively early, although Texas also had moved up to Super Tuesday, because you're really making it hard on the less well-funded. California, obviously the most expensive state to run in of all states. There are four major...
Can we just do the list here? It's outrageous.
Yeah, what?
It's Alabama, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Democrats abroad, Minnesota, Massachusetts, North Carolina,
this
Oklahoma,
is Super Tuesday.
Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, and Virginia. So just the media markets there alone: San Francisco, Los Angeles,
San
Houston,
Diego,
Dallas, San Diego, Washington, D.C.,
San
Boston.
Antonio. Right. So this is...
Charlotte.
Right. So I think...
Huge
media. I'm not sure how this happened or what the circumstances are. Democratic Party faces two interesting challenges with this enormous number of candidates, right? One of them is that unlike the Republican Party, they do not have... Their states are not often, delegates are not apportioned winner take all. They are apportioned, proportionately, right? So if you win 50% of the vote, you only get half the delegates, and the delegates are spread. And then there's like, I think, a 15% floor. Like if you get below 15%, you don't get any delegates. This is a potential problem, because the Bernie Sanders forces compelled changes in the convention rules that weaken the party regulars on the first ballot. In other words, like there were a lot the so-called superdelegates. These are regular party officials who do not have to run on slates with candidates. And so when Sanders was charging, Hillary Clinton could walk around saying, look, we're going to win anyway. We have all the superdelegates. So the Sanders people decided the superdelegate rules were terrible, and the superdelegates now are only going to be able to vote on the second ballot. But this means it's going to be very hard for somebody if there are four or five serious candidates to get enough delegates on the first ballot to secure the nomination. And therefore, you could have a situation in which Trump appears to be, sitting atop a totally united party, and the Democrats are fighting and squabbling and having backdoor negotiations and stuff all through the summer. And so that's not great for them. However, the last 2 months with Biden, solidifying his 20-point national lead, a move like this in California would say to you, the only person who's really going to benefit from this is Biden, because the more in a big state, the more famous you are, the more the likelier it is that you will do well. And so you could have a situation in which Biden, say, you know, gets 45 or 50% of the vote in California, and then he gets 50% of the delegates, and suddenly he's way ahead.
You know, what's interesting about that, though, is because the great 2016 takeaway for the disgruntled Democratic base was how the system was stacked against the non-established favorite. Mm-hmm. And here we are.
And here we are. Possibly it's getting restacked. And then, as Christine pointed out just before the show, word came down that the DNC and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committees are threatening Democratic consultants with blackballing and blacklisting should they go to work for insurgent candidates who are going to stage primary challenges to sitting elected politicians, which is an eerily similar kind of move to the way Republican regulars acted in 2010 when people were primarying Republican regulars, like, or in 2012, Ted Cruz taking on Demarest, the... Demarest, wasn't that his name? Not Demarest.
Yeah, the other guy.
What was his name? It's driving me crazy. Okay, taking on
the other irony of the complaints about the
DeRocher, not DeRocher.
The irony too is that a lot of these so-called insurgent outsiders are themselves backed by groups like Justice Democrats. So it's not like these are, you know, these individualistic outsiders who decide to, you know, put the country ahead of themselves. They're actively recruited by far left groups in order to primary other Democrats. So that also gets lost.
David Dewhurst.
Thank you, yeah. It's really enjoyable to watch a sort of a nascent Tea Party form on the left, because we were told so often that they were constitutionally incapable of that kind of fractious internecine warfare, because this was the party of government. And all they really wanted to do is make things work.
Right. Well, I mean, so the stories that came out over the weekend about this were all about how this is really terrible because, you know, this is the only way, we thought the Democrats were the party of women, this is the only way to get women like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez into the party leaders, to take on party regulars the way she took on Joe Crowley in New York, thus vitiating the whole idea that, you know, political parties do not sacrifice something for nothing. They do not easily sacrifice an incumbent for a challenger, particularly if the incumbent is somebody who has been like a good soldier, right? So what they say is, well, what does it matter? These are safe seats. Like, no Republican's going to take it away. So why can't somebody new fill it? And of course, the answer is they're right. The party has no business putting its thumb on the scale for people. But on the other hand, just because they're right theoretically doesn't mean practically that means anything. It is a way of fomenting civil war within a party. And though you may say that the Tea Party, then you have this whole question of what that leads to. Like, the Tea Party and its its philosophy had a lot to do with Trump taking over the party in 2015, 2016. Now, you can say that was ultimately, a lot of people think that was a triumph and a fulfillment on the grounds of the philosophy that the Tea Party was promulgating, which was limited government, extremely restrained government spending, and a kind of religious adherence to constitutional norms. Obviously, those were all totally violated by Trump, and yet the Tea Party has now revealed its commitment to these ideas as hollow by its total embrace of Trump and total rejection, as Noah's written about, of its supposedly enlightened stance in favor of the restraints on constitutional authority, particularly the president's authority by the Constitution, and their commitment to government, to holding government spending and ending government departments and stuff like that. Right?
Just libertarian economics generally. Free markets, international trade, and in opposition to profligacy, that is the kind of stuff that begets inflationary pressures, which is, you know, the biggest fear of the Reagan Revolution and the whole, you know, a lot of political capital was spent on controlling inflation to the point now where we've had a generation that doesn't understand what inflation is.
Right. So anyway, that's so the interesting
thing. I think it's just cost of living.
Right. So the interesting thing for the Democrats is that to the extent that they embrace, if you want to follow the logic, to the extent that they embrace people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez so much that they stop this policy, which may happen actually because of the power of this counter argument, that they stop the policy of punishing people for daring to work for, you know, insurgents. And then when the insurgents really do take over the party and that party wins a presidential election, it will be somebody who does not adhere to the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez ideology at all, or the insurgent ideology at all. Could be a total betrayal of it, and yet they'll end up falling in line. If that's
they may fall in line eventually, but I do think all of this will hurt Democratic turnout in the general election, especially sort of if they feel, you know, among the insurgent base and those who were in favor of minority candidates. I mean, if they feel sort of twice burned.
We had a similar conversation around Republicans in 2016 too.
And
it didn't hurt their turnout.
Well, I mean,
we talked about how at a brokered convention, it wasn't really brokered, but there was a whole lot of disunity on the floor and a real sustained effort to dump the nominee. And that was supposed to result in, you know, decreased enthusiasm by the general election. But what happens is you have 852 news cycles between the convention and the general election.
Mm. I mean, you don't know. It all depends on what the, you know, what the things firing people up are. We also don't know how large the insurgent class is in the Democratic Party. I mean, we know that the Tea Party and its the Tea Party was a genuine grassroots movement that, you know, turned out millions of people in various events and things that happened and all that. And so aside from the Women's March, which was, you know, amazingly enough, if you think about it, it was 2.5 years ago now, something like that. It's not like there's been a lot of street action.
No, but even worse, it's evolved into something that looks a little bit more like political action.
How so? What do you mean?
I mean, they're no longer on the streets. They actually began to organize and get people out to the polls. That was the story of 2018. The Women's March abandoned the Women's March and gravitated more towards GOTV organizations.
Right, but that's also what happened with the Tea Party. I mean, in that sense, it was success. The question is, where is that energy and enthusiasm now? Bernie Sanders said something interesting this weekend that struck me as the first serious reason for Democrats to start getting cold feet about Biden. Because it was the first non-ideological attack on Biden that resonated with me. And it was, he said, we need voters to be excited in 2020 about voting for a Democrat. So this was an implicit attack on, right, Biden's running I'm the safe choice, I want to get Trump out, I'm not a lunatic like all these people. But there is a real case to be made that this then will totally depend on anti-Trump fury to generate the enthusiasm that the party would need to vote Trump out. And Bernie's got something there that there is a real, if you think about presidential candidacies and particularly Democratic presidential candidacies, without the ability to generate some kind of a love affair between the candidate and the party, that lack of enthusiasm can lead to, you know, the shocking Hillary Clinton defeat.
But there are two challenges Bernie faces there. One is that he's now getting a lot more pressure from Elizabeth Warren on his left flank to kind of garner that energy, right? She's his biggest challenger within the progressive left in terms of voters, and his candidacy is struggling in a way to revive the energy that he had before. The other thing is that this is what the will or won't they impeach challenge seems to be, and that is now very bounded by the calendar, right? It basically, if it's going to happen, it has to happen in June, because after the July 4th, Congress goes on recess. In August, they're not there. If Pelosi's going to move forward with impeachment, it's got to happen in this month. And that, of course, is what a lot of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party thinks will be energizing to voters in the next election. But the polls don't quite show it yet. So I think that Bernie really does have this. He has to somehow deal with Warren if he's going to be the exciting alternative to Biden.
Also, the polarizing candidate has the reciprocal effect on their opponents. They can energize the opposition just as much. And I mean, the argument that I've seen made, and I tend to agree with, is that Donald Trump wasn't the polarizing candidate in 2016. It was Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was the polarizing candidate because of the fact that she had essentially a halo of criminality around her, or a war of criminality around her. That Donald Trump was controversial, but he wasn't the actual crook, and the crook message was resonated.
Well, I mean, I think she was the polarizing. I mean, that was the great success of the Trump campaign was in making sure the Trump campaign and James Comey, the actual person who got Hillary Clinton elected, in creating condition under which Trump, who should have been the issue in 2016, you know, in a conventional circumstance, you would have. Hillary and the Democrats' effort to make it clear that Trump was somebody who should not be put in the White House, which was certainly the focus of most media attention, he managed to keep the pressure on her and the focus on her in that way. And obviously that would be his intention with whoever he runs against in 2020. Calling, you know, Biden tired or sleepy or stupid or something, what won't be enough. He would need something, if Biden were the nominee, he would need something more frightening that Biden himself represents, whereas which he has with Bernie and with Warren, right? Which is socialism and,
right.
You know, the actual aggressive advocacy of socialism, and if Biden, you know, is a vaguer candidate, it's not so easy to make that stick with people who, you know, watching the kind of the oppo attacks on Biden now, and the stuff that's being done in the media by, say, Andrew Kaczynski of CNN and stuff like that. You're doing the thing where you're going back to things he said about Strom Thurmond in 1985. That's 35 years ago. I mean, people are, you know, really not going to allow something that he said 35 years ago about a senile, doddering old fool who was once a very bad guy to be the standard by which you judge him in, you know, in 2020.
I don't think Bernie will have any problem being the excitement candidate in time. I mean, I sound like a broken record, but I still think he's going to have his moment, because as this process goes on, he's going to have reason to be in the spotlight and in front of cameras and at debates and on stages and say things. And when he is exposed to the public, that is when the buzz, he does generate this buzz organically, and that will come on again.
I tend to agree with you also because, I mean, the assumption here is that Joe Biden has the biggest target on his back on the debate stage. But I'm not sure that's true, because everybody else is running in this progressive bona fides primary that Biden isn't competing in. So if their objective is to demonstrate their own progressive values on stage in order to compete for the progressive vote, which makes up a giant portion of the Democratic electorate, it's just split up all across like 10 candidates, then it would be the Bernie versus Warren versus Harris versus half a dozen other candidates with Pete Buttigieg trying to split the middle, and Biden essentially emerging unscathed. And yeah, so he might benefit in the long run from that process, but the focus would most certainly be on the progressive primary in which Bernie Sanders is the front runner.
You could be exactly right, but the experience of 2016 would suggest to me, if they're watching and sort of follow, assume that there are some lessons of human nature to be learned even from the party that they are not a member of, the clear drastic mistake that was made by the campaigns in 2016,
right,
was in not attacking Trump as the front runner. I mean, that was the, you know, remember Mike Murphy who was Jeb's consultant, saying, you know, I got to run the race I got to run. I need to knock Rubio out. I need to knock Cruz and Rubio out so that my lane is only taken up by Jeb. And so there's Trump punching Jeb in the face, and Jeb's like, I'm not going to fight you. You know, my problem, you know, it's Chris Christie attacking Rubio, and Trump sails along. You know, nobody wants to attack him because they're looking to take voters from in their lane. Mm-hmm. If you have somebody who is getting close to 40% in the polls and you don't knock him down, he's going to win and you're going to lose. Like, that's, it's overthinking. It's too clever by halfness to say that the front runner isn't the front runner. And if I can just cohere three different votes and, you know, and attach them to me, and then I can outdistance him by a point or a point and a half. Biden will walk into the nomination unless his numbers are knocked down. I mean, he is at the level at which people win nominations, you know, particularly in a divided party. So, you know, they have to go after him. If they don't, that it's just like, you know, I don't know.
And he's behaving that way sort of strategically and wisely, I would think. I mean, this is why he didn't go to the California State Democratic Convention. He was speaking to a human rights watch group. And, you know, his name was booed because he wasn't there, because these were very progressive audience. But he's, you know, he really is the contrast, right? He's not for Medicare for all. He's staked out these centrist positions. And, you know, those are the positions that actually majority of voters are more sympathetic to. So I think that's right. I really do think that I do think, though, that Bernie and Warren have to have their moment. Someone's got to win that battle, because that's where the anti-Biden group really is, right? I mean, if he's going to sail to it, the only challenge has got to come from either Warren or Sanders.
I mean, Sanders is winning. Better. Sanders is winning that battle. I mean, he's 10 yes. points up on her. It's
for now.
Yeah. I mean, but there, I think it's 10. I think he's around 20 and she's around 10.
I think it's gotten a little closer to parity over the last month or two.
Hold on. Let me go to...
it depends on the poll you look at, obviously, but Warren has had a bit of a moment for herself, and Bernie's been slipping. And the assumption here is that they're basically trading their share of the vote. Nobody can test that proposition,
yeah,
obviously.
Whatever. He is still marginal. I mean, hold on. Let me see. Okay, so the national RCP average has Sanders up 7.5 over Warren. He's at 16.5, she's at 9. Biden's at 35, by the way. So he's literally doubling Sanders's more than doubling Sanders's vote. Biden's ahead 4 in Iowa, and he's ahead, according to this, 13 in New Hampshire. By the way, if that holds anywhere near right, if Biden wins Iowa and New Hampshire, then all of this talk is nonsense because he wins the nomination. He just walks into the nomination at that point. So there are two different things here, one of which is he's got to get knocked down nationally, and he's got to get knocked down in the early states to some extent. Like,
and then Biden pivots to the general election in February of 2020.
That's right. Well, that also gives Trump, you know, 9 months to go at him, which is still better for Biden than not.
So many angry tweets.
But that's why you're looking at this and you're saying, oh, it's a lifetime till Election Day. The first debate is in a month. And the first primary is 7 months after that first debate. And we are going to know a lot after that first debate, because I assume we're going to know how these campaigns are thinking. And we'll also know whether or not, in fact, the debate format is so awful that the nature of this race with 23, 24 people in it is so awful that it really will only leave two people in any kind of a memorable position. And then you'll have Buttigieg as the media darling giving the wonderful, you know, graceful riposte to something or other. And he'll, you know, and then there'll be this constant effort to push him forward, which will, you know, gain him 3 or 4 points.
Yeah, I very much think those numbers will be shook up dramatically and soon. I mean, this is still sort of feels kind of like the almost the pre-race race. You know, I think things will change once we start hearing from them regularly.
You know,
I mean, the dynamic of a two-person race is that, yes, that can happen. The dynamic of a multi-party race from 2012 and 2016, at least, is that the front runner stays the front runner.
You know, I don't want to, I am, you know, on record, I've written pieces about how Biden is a fool and a logorrheic and a silly person and all of that. And, you know, like everybody else, I'm like, well, he ran twice before and he only got 1% of the vote. But, you know, all these circumstances are totally different. First of all, he didn't really run in 88. He dropped out of the race before he even ran because he was discovered to have plagiarized this Neil Kinnock anecdote about Neil Kinnock himself, Neil Kinnock's family. And then in 2008, he was running quite half-heartedly in some weird foreign policy lane that nobody was interested in, and he had really nothing to commend himself for. He comes into this race, you know, having been a vice president for 8 years, with this terrible, tragic, moving life story that people don't really know, and the candidacy has been made possible by the fact that he's running against somebody who is in his mid-70s, and he's in his mid to later 70s. If Trump were 15 years younger, this would not even be a theoretical possibility. And his main rival is also in his mid-70s. So the one thing that would make it, that would have made it in any other election cycle an impossibility for him to run, which is his age, is now not a liability anymore, unless he coughs. I mean, literally, unless he coughs, unless he has to go off the campaign trail because he's sick for a couple of days, like, that stuff could be bad, you know.
Or has a moment that could be interpreted as
a
his,
senior moment. Right. Yeah. So I'm just saying, like, you know, I don't want to praise Biden. I really don't. Although, you know, he seems to be, so far, he is. The things that we thought were dumb, which were the sort of apologies and, you know, saying he gets it about touching people, all that, I think looking back, or as a, you know, you have to look at this and say, this has been a masterful 2019. He sawed off some of the rough edges with the handsiness stuff, which could have been a real issue for him. And then when he entered the race, he just floated up way up top. Now, could that change? Yeah, it could change.
You know, that's really very interesting that he's actually pretty much neutralized Anita Hill. And Anita Hill has done everything within her power to make him a toxic figure and mm-hmm. has failed.
But again, it's 27 years ago. I mean, look, I'm old enough. Old enough for all of this to have happened when I was in my 30s, but I am not a conventional Democratic voter here. That's 27 years ago. When he said something nice about Strom Thurmond, it was 35 years ago. When he championed the crime bill, it was 25 years ago. And when he says, look, that was another world in which, you know, I passed the crime bill, and sure, there are things I do differently now, but then, you know, the country was in a crisis or all of that, that's not just neutralizable. I mean, it's not that I think, you know, he can't run on the crime bill, as Rudy Giuliani learned. Even 7 years after 9/11, you can't run on 9/11 either.
Like, she is out there as a figure in the media today saying that, and he's calling her and introducing her into the national conversation, and she's saying, rejecting these overtures very aggressively, and that's not generating any traction.
Yeah, but I think that's as much to do with Anita Hill as it is to do with Joe Biden. I mean, there's a sense in which, you know, she's trotted out to kind of be this moral conscience on sexual harassment without any sort of discussion of the fact that, you know, a lot of people still don't believe that she told the truth. So I think that the doubt that has, you know, there's always been this kind of, you know, martyr halo that surrounded her if you're on the feminist left, but there's been a similar a cloud of questions that have hung over her participation in Clarence Thomas's hearings for a lot of other people. So she's, in some ways, she remains a complicated person to be raising these issues of truthfulness and you know, liability for a potential candidate. And the younger Me Too type feminists have not been galvanized in the same way her as I think they
wanted because to. They're also ahistoric. Those people, the younger Me Too feminists, these are oddly enough, not that this is history, but they're very ahistorical people. Like, they don't care. They don't care what happened to Anita Hill. They're interested in their pain. They're interested in their suffering. They don't want to know about what happened in the past. Like, they don't. They barely even know anything happened in the past.
But that actually reflects how small a contingent this actually is, because they're very receptive to what is essentially a primal scream. She's not asking for anything. She doesn't have any particular wants or desires or some sort of a course of action that she could see from Joe Biden or Democrats generally. It's just, you know, wind back the clock and undo what was done.
Yes, that's a good point. That's right.
Yeah, but I mean, again, if you're going to have, like, stage kabuki dances over things that happened, you know, that really is, by the way, unilateral disarmament in this sense, which is that Trump gets to do anything he wants whenever he wants, and then the Democrats are going to say, well, you are totally inappropriate because of something you said in 1986. It's like, so you're literally going to hold, I understand, you know, it's terrible that Trump is changing standards, but, you know, Trump himself, this ridiculous comedy of him attacking the crime, Joe Biden's crime bill from the left. I mean,
well, he has prison reform now under his belt.
Yeah, but so he's trying to do is push Democratic buttons, and if they're stupid enough to fall for his button pushing, then they deserve what they get, you know. And you know what you deserve, Abe? What you deserve is
plenty.
A good night's sleep is what you deserve, because you're a hardworking, serious person, and your life, you think too much and you can't get to sleep. And so it's very important that you understand that the World Health Organization has named the health epidemic of the 21st century, and it's stress, Abe. We're feeling more uncertainty and anxiety than ever before, and that's why we're partnering with Calm, the number one rated app for meditation. When you meditate, your brain chemistry changes. Meditation has been shown to slow down the release of stress chemicals into your bloodstream, like cortisol and adrenaline, giving you some much-needed relief. So with Calm, you'll discover a whole library of simple guided meditations on themes like anxiety, creativity, and focus. They even have other resources to help you relax, like sleep stories, music, and more. So if you're stressed, take a deep breath and get Calm. Right now, Commentary listeners get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/commentary. That's calm.com/commentary. 40 million people have downloaded Calm. Find out why at calm.com/commentary. So the other interesting thing about what Bernie said when he said that there wasn't going to be sufficient excitement on the left, enthusiasm, excitement among Democrats, is we've now seen this supposed rise in Warren's fortunes, right? Because she's introducing lots of policy. That's what we're told. Every day she introduces a new policy. It's so exciting. Policy, policy, policy. So much policy. It's crazy. And that's an interesting theory. I like the idea that politics is the result of, you know, policy proposals. We've just literally had a presidential election that made it clear that that was not the case. but let's just say that this is true. So is there going to be an idea? Is there an idea ferment among liberals and the left that will generate its own enthusiasm outside of, you know, the upshot in the New York Times desperately trying to, you know, imagine that there's wonderful policy being done here? Will there be sort of like policy ferment? Will these debates feature interesting policy discussions and ideas about what to do with the country if they get it into their hands and all of that? Or is that an illusion?
I think there is one. Generally speaking, I think voters no longer care all that much about policy, sadly. I think there's one exception, and that is when candidates start talking about giving away free things. That's the policy that does capture people's imaginations. Now, does that make for an interesting policy discussion? I don't particularly think so, because none of it tends to make much mathematical sense, and either you sort of accept the fantasy math involved or you don't.
So I have trouble getting into the ideological debate in the Democratic primary, in part because I find it so cosmetic. Superficially, we're talking about socialism versus the status quo. But no one's actually really talking about socialism. We're not talking about the nationalization of the commanding heights of the economy. We're not talking about the displacement of classes and beyond simple one-time wealth transfers here and there. We're really not talking about interclass disputes, societal organization. We're not talking about that. It's very programmatic, marginal policy-oriented ideas, and maybe like pack the courts, some stuff that's never going to happen, and that sort of thing happens in these primaries where you talk about your fantasy proposals. But you know, generally, it's pretty much tinkering around the edges and very much programmatic appeals. And that's, you know, fine. But it's not really as engaging as I think the intellectual discussion is on the right, and which began in 2016. Now, Donald Trump has absolutely no interest in intellectual debate, but he was representative of an intellectual current on the American right that began questioning the foundational assumptions of the philosophy going back 200, 300 years, which resulted in what I think is a much more intellectually vibrant movement today. You know, one of my gripes with Paul Krugman is, besides the fact that he writes the exact same column every 3 weeks, is that he sees this as an intellectually defunct and dead and boring movement. And it's precisely the opposite. It is the most interesting thing happening in American politics today, is the debate on the intellectual right. The left seems generally okay with the consensus. As much as they talk about progressive socialism, but none of them actually embrace it.
Well, I'm not sure, first of all, that debate began in 2016. I mean,
yeah,
I think there's
predates.
There's a lot of, I mean, I don't mean the debate about whether or not the Enlightenment was bad. That's more of a kind of political philosophy debate about the origins and nature of the legitimacy of the American regime.
But that sort of thing was isolated, right, on a very marginalized portion of the intellectual right that had no relevance, right, prior to 2015, 2016, which all of a sudden it became part of the general conversation.
Right. So I would say there are two strains on the liberal left that are intellectually interesting, and yet tend toward despair rather than programmatic things that will make life better. You know, that this is part of the issue here is that right now, unlike the pessimism sold, saying America's crappy and we can make it great again is mostly saying America's crappy, which was Trump's thing. But there are two major philosophical trends on the left that are self-defeating, but I think are interesting, and they're serious, and they need to be grappled with. One is the entire discussion of income inequality, which sounds boring, but is in fact a very large question that encompasses all the technological changes in the world economy, the way people work, the way wealth is generated, where the wealth goes, how it's distributed, what it means about work in the future, how people need to be educated to be part of the workforce and to be successes and all of that. And yet the problem is that the more one studies income inequality, the clearer I think it is to the people who are obsessed with it that it is an intractable, there is no solution to it, that it is a description of a reality rather than a warning about a future that needs to be changed, that it's almost impossible to figure out how on earth you would reverse this income inequality except through financial expropriation, which would not only potentially end income inequality, but would end wealth generation, and thus would be self-defeating. And the other is global warming or climate change, which is also a serious idea that goes to all the same things about who we are, what we do with our resources, what morality attaches to our stewardship of the earth and all of that. And it too leads to despair in the sense that there's no real hope for anything. And thus I think the liberal ideas, which are not without power, ideas on the left or whatever, nonetheless do not generate the kind of ferment that a lot of ideas on the right have over the last 20 years, because they create a feedback loop of passivity, despair, and you know, this is part of what you wrote about.
So you need a burn it all down candidate in order to move the window to actually talk about these ideas as though they're intractable societal problems that can't be resolved within our current framework, so you have to destroy everything and remake it from the ground up in order to have the real debate about ideology.
That's why Elizabeth Warren's policy stuff is so interesting in this context. I think this is right. She's basically running around saying if we 2 cents on all the billionaires will buy you universal childcare, it'll pay off all student debt, it'll give us Medicaid for all. It is an attempt to have a sort of good messaging about income inequality without actually digging down and dealing with the complicated causes of income inequality. So in that sense, I think that's going to fall flat eventually. And Noah's right. The guy who says it, or the gal who says the whole system is screwed, let's burn it down, is more likely to galvanize
people. Expropriate all the wealth. Why stop at 2%?
So you're saying Bill de Blasio is the candidate for our time?
Well, I mean, no one is actually dealing with the ultimate logic of their arguments here.
I also want to object to the idea, sadly, because I would love to say that, you know, all intellectual ferment is on the right and it's also interesting and everything like that. I think so much intellectual energy has gone over the last 2.5 years to trying to give some ballast to Trumpism and to come up with a set of philosophical terms that will say that who Trump is and what he's doing and all of that is actually either part of an existing political philosophy or the foundation of a newly created political, ideological, moral consensus. And while it would be pretty to think so, because it would be great not to be nihilistic about where we are and think, LOL, nothing matters. That all works until Trump opens his mouth or writes a tweet, and then it doesn't work at all. And then there is no philosophy. You know, it's like these guys are, you know, Plato, and they're teaching Alexander the Great, and then Alexander the Great goes out and says, I don't like Plato, I like porn. You know, it doesn't...
Plato's a stone-cold loser.
I mean, you can't...
Well, all that effort to fit a square peg in a round hole gives us the opportunity to have actual intellectual discussions around the idea, so I kind of enjoy that.
Okay, but I'm just saying that it's all this
pure onanism to actually just talk about Rousseau.
But I think John's right in that. I think the problem is that the most profitable way to analyze Trump and his effect is not through the lens of politics. He's a phenomenon that means things in other realms too. You know, it's a sort of a mass psychological phenomenon to some degree.
Yeah, I would analogize it like this, that if you take somebody who is an improvisatory jazz musician and does whatever he does on the spur of the moment based on what comes into his head and can play some brilliant riffs and do some amazing original things and all of that, and that you say that he's Beethoven writing 50 part, you know, writing, orchestrating a symphony for 50 different instruments. You are not describing the improviser can't be Beethoven. It's fine, by the way. Like, the improviser can be the improviser, and then you learn wisdom from whatever it is that the improvisations produce. But you can't simultaneously say that what he is doing is considered, thought through, you know, based on previous, you know, based on, just as Mozart taught Beethoven, you know, so it's based on previous ideas and all that. You can't do that. It doesn't make sense. It's just a kind of foolishness.
Well, but it's an interesting...
Christine's a classically trained musician, by the way, so she maybe
I played the bassoon to pay my way through college. But I will say this, the improviser often knows his audience better than the people trying to insist he's Beethoven. He knows he's not. He's not trying to be. But there is this kind of conservative intellectual class and somewhat of a conservative pundit class that really wants to believe that there's a philosophy fueling this behavior. I don't think Trump needs one. Trump is Trump. And I think a large part of the people who turned out to vote for him in the last election, they're there because they want to hear some improvisation. They don't want to hear Beethoven.
And you know what? As we're talking about the progenitors of ideas and all of that, I want to talk a little about Ancestry.com. Because do you ever wonder where your family comes from? You can discover more about them and learn about your story by combining the Ancestry DNA test with billions of historical family records. Christine, I have you done any of this work with your family?
I have not. I actually was contacted by someone who worked on the Hill years ago who had tracked down some of my Stolba ancestors, which is in the former Czech Republic, Bohemia. But I haven't done Ancestry.com yet. I'm curious about it.
You know, we need you to do it, I think, because we've been through Noah's background. And we know that Abe's background is 98% Ashkenazic Jewish, and mine is like 107% Ashkenazic Jewish, which is why I haven't, because I really don't know what the, if I were in this position, I think I would be just totally obsessed with this, because, you know, Ancestry DNA gives you so much more than just the places you're from. Ancestry connects you to the places in the world where your story started using precise geographical detail and clear-cut historical insights. You can even trace your ancestors' journeys over time, following how and why your family moved from place to place. And to amplify your results, you can start a free trial on Ancestry and build a tree so your ancestors become more than just a name. They've combined DNA results with over 100 million family trees and billions of records to give you more insight into your genealogy and origins. Only Ancestry can tell such a rich story with unique features that give a more complete picture about a person, like events that shaped them, how they made a living, and what they excelled in. Ancestry's unique features and record collections can give a more complete picture of people from your past, like the events that shaped them, how they made a living, even how long they attended school. It's so easy to get started. Go to Ancestry.com/commentary today for 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. That's Ancestry.com/commentary for 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com/commentary. Donald Trump is in is at Buckingham Palace as we speak, where he is attempting to brush under the rug some of the more offensive stuff he has done in relation to the Brits over the last couple of years. And then on Thursday, he will go to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the landing at Omaha Beach and D-Day. This is a, you know, this should be a, you know, knockout. I don't know. It's like a softball pitch. You can hit out of the park. It's a beautiful, glorious, stunning occasion. One of the great achievements of Western, you know, that all Western civilization was building up to, you know, extirpating this evil force from within itself of the Nazis through this technological know-how, bravery, social seriousness, and all that was also part of the West's birthright. Do we think he'll knock it out of the park?
Well, he did a good job of it during his State of the Union address. I mean, he built that around the Allied victory,
mm-hmm. Right?
But that's there are no curveballs being thrown at him there. This is, you know, he's got to sort of wing it here. Not wing it, but
if he were to watch television, which he does a lot, and someone were to transpose his political stature, his political position here, with some sort of link to National Socialism, he might be inclined to defend himself, which would be an abject disaster. most likely, though, I suspect that if it's anything like the last, like the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landings, that the actual celebration itself will be far more humiliating than anything Donald Trump says.
Right. Well,
do you ever remember the interpretive dance?
Oh God! Yes.
Hour-long interpretive dance that was commemorating the landings. It was a horror.
Well, I
not
will
quite as horrible, but
I will say this about Trump's European trip, that one thing that has often been the case whenever a Republican president, even an unconventional Republican president like Trump does when he goes abroad, is that it's a moment for the Europeans to express their superiority over America, right? Oh, it's so vain, so vulgar, stupid, the presidents are stupid, all that stuff. And Trump is going to Europe at a moment of unparalleled political destabilization for Europe. So the major European countries, so Merkel's on her way out in Germany, Macron is in disastrous shape in France, May has resigned in Great Britain, and is, you know, they're on their way to an election in which right now the first poll taken has the Brexit Party leading in a four-way race above the Tories and the Tories and Labour. So the notion that we, you know, our president is going abroad and the Europeans have got no way to turn their nose up at us when their house is so in horrible disorder. But
they'll find a way.
Well, they'll do it, but its ineffectuality, I think, will be hilarious.
I saw something on Twitter a minute ago of somebody projecting on the Tower of London the opinion polls reflecting that 71% of the British public has a favorable opinion of Barack Obama and only 22% have a favorable opinion of Donald Trump. The relevance of this escapes me, but it is somehow... Part of the conversation.
That's a very big deal for some people. Never for me, but that's a big talking point. You know, like for a certain portion of the
popular
of the American public. No. That I'm embarrassed about how what our European friends think of our president. Not talking about the governments, but the people.
I guess. Yeah.
I mean. When I attained my majority in 1979, it was axiomatic that Europe had both a superior political culture and a superior aesthetic culture to the United States, and that we were secondary to them. We should have had a parliamentary system like England. We should have a culture that respects high culture like France. We should have the economic culture of Sweden, all of that. So that was, 40 years ago, right? And 40 years later, I don't know that Europe can make a particularly good case for itself in any of these realms. I mean, it's not that we can make such a great case for ourselves, but the general proposition is somehow that because we are, it presumes we are the leader of the world in almost every respect, and therefore, if we've elected somebody who falls short of what the world needs or wants or expects, that we've done the world an injustice, because including Europe, because they need us to be better than and they need us to be better because they stink, that's a huge, I mean, if you think about it, I know it's two generations ago, but that's a very big turnaround in a kind of understanding of how the world works. The contempt that the intelligentsia of Europe felt for the United States, for its voters, for its culture, for its leaders, was something that the elites in the United States inhered and accepted as punishment for being Americans. Terrible. So they deserve it. Anyway, so I guess with that, we will say adieu for today and reconvene on Thursday for Abe, Christine, and Noah. I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.